Thanks, David. Well, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to our workshop session this morning titled Secular Growth in Emerging Markets and How to Get Access to It. As David said, my name is Darren Hall. Just an A, not an I. And I'm the National Manager for third-party distribution here in Australia, looking after a lot of our dealer group relationships, our research relationships and advisors. And once again, we're very pleased to have a key member of our Global Equity Portfolio Management team join us here today, Portfolio Manager for Global Equity Large Cap, Scott Berg. And if you're fortunate enough to be at the conference last year, you might recall that we presented on a session titled Why Emerging Markets Are Critical to Global Equity Investing. And the timing of last year's conference was the fourth week of August, similar sort of timing to this year's conference. And I guess in terms of what's happened since then, I think a lot has obviously changed, but hopefully once you walk out of the room today, you'll have the conviction or a clearer thought process in how we think about emerging markets. So as Graham said this morning, you know, what exactly has changed? I think if you look at since that conference last year, I think everyone sort of points to September 15 as being the date that you know, Lehman Brothers obviously filed for Chapter 11 and the US subprime crisis became a global financial crisis. And at that point we saw severe market dislocation, forced selling, very high levels of volatility and risk aversion, which obviously doesn't bode well for growth assets, doesn't bode well for financial markets or equity investing, and as we found out, it certainly doesn't bode well for investments in direct investments in emerging markets. But one thing we do know is that the global financial crisis, the epicenter of the global financial crisis, wasn't actually in the emerging markets. It was something where it was a developed world creation, with the epicenter being the US. So T. Rowe Price, we strongly feel that the economic growth prospects are still very strong within emerging markets. The question as portfolio construction practitioners, as advisors, as researchers, is how do you actually get access to that theme? And that's essentially what we're talking to today. So in the new reality, what actually has changed? In fact, if you've seen our flyers, you would see that our conviction to emerging markets is certainly fundamental in terms of how we construct our global equity portfolios, and we believe that our conviction is in where this growth is coming from is even stronger today. If you look at the MSCI Emerging Market Index, it's actually rallied 88% in US dollar terms from its trough on the 27th of October 2008, demonstrating that there certainly is still strong sentiment from how the market perceives this asset class as certainly being attractive in terms of its investment appeal. So if you put aside the immense volatility that we've seen within emerging markets, there's still very strong secular growth that we're going to be talking to today. And this secular growth was and continues to be very strong over the last decade. And we're just going to highlight some of the key things that we're looking at right now at T. Rowe Price. In terms of how we construct portfolios at T. Rowe Price, we certainly think within the global equity space you shouldn't be constrained by an index. You should have a very broad opportunity set in terms of where your portfolio has access to. And for us, that is developed markets, it is emerging markets, and at times it is even frontier markets. So our presentation today will put forward and highlight that there still is a strong case to consider having some emerging markets in your portfolio. The decision for investors, as you in the room and being attendees of this conference, is how you get access to that theme. As I said earlier, presenting today is Scott Berg, Global Large Cap Equity Portfolio Manager at T. Rowe Price. Scott is a key part of our Global Equity Portfolio Management team. This team does include Rob Gensler, who's Portfolio Manager for the T. Rowe Price Global Equity Fund, currently available to Australian investors, who many of you will be familiar with and perhaps are currently have clients invested in that particular strategy. And if you look at Scott's CV just quickly, he has a very, very highly decorated CV in terms of his achievements, and like any organisation, T. Rowe Price looks to attract, develop and retain the highest calibre of staff at all times, and Scott is surely a key example of that, being with the firm for 7 years, worked up through the analyst pool. T. Rowe Price has a dedicated intern program where we look to recruit from the top business schools around the world, including Stanford, Wharton, Harvard, London Business School. Those interns typically join T. T Rowe over a summer period, so right now, and are given a panel of stocks to analyse. They then present those stocks back up to our equity steering committee, and if successful, are granted a position at T Rowe Price. And if you look at Scott's CV, he's actually an expat Australian, currently residing in London with an American accent. So it's quite interesting when we introduce Scott to the stage. But graduated number one at Macquarie University in his actuarial studies. Was a business analyst at McKinsey & Co. Worked for Consumer Mead, married an American. Studied at Stanford University, where he graduated number one in his MBA class, and was invited to T. Rowe Price as an analyst, where he's continued his high achievements, being a recipient of the Best of the Buy Side Award as a research analyst, and more recently being elevated up into the role as portfolio manager. So please welcome Scott Berg to the stage.
Thank you very much. Good to be here again. We're going to talk about emerging markets, and I guess before I kick off, it's hard to talk about emerging markets today, given the year we've been through and the craziness in the world, not to talk about the world more broadly. Right. So hopefully you won't be disappointed as we come away from this. We're going to touch on a lot of EM stuff, but in our view, emerging markets now are such an integrated part of the world, in a sense. They're a much bigger part of the world than I think many people realise. And so we'll touch on some of the overall global stuff as well to put that in perspective. I don't think you can address it without it. And as Darren said, it was very interesting, having been here last year, talking about emerging markets and our conviction right ahead of the fall. I'm actually glad to be back here to be able to talk about after the fall to say what's changed and what hasn't, you know. And we clearly had some shocks last year. It was a head spinner. So the first one is just putting last year was a painful year, but to put that in perspective of just how extreme it was, this is a distribution of S&P equity returns from the 20s through to today. And you see that the 2008 number, it wasn't just a bad year. It was right out at the tail end of that distribution. And so in one sense, okay, people know it was painful. Lots of things went down. It was historic. But through the other lens, coming out of years like this, you very often get some of the best returns to risky asset classes, not surprisingly, right? So, you know, 1974's over here, you know, 1975, you know, right near the top of the distribution there. You know, same with many of the other years. The 30s is a little bit different. You had a bunch of really terrible years, 30, 31, 37. You had a bunch of phenomenal years, 33, 35. So, you know, that was obviously the last time we had this kind of real craziness, and it ebbed and flowed for a bit longer. But it was a tough year. But not just was it a tough year that maybe leads to some opportunities, it was a tough year that came on the back of a decade that already hadn't been especially great. So this is rolling 10-year returns for the S&P, and if you used a global benchmark, it wouldn't be that different. And again, this is back to 1880 here. At the end of last year, the cumulative return for US equities over 10 years was negative, and there was only one other time in history that had happened, which was in the 30s. Okay, and the important part of that is last year was a terrible year, but again, it came on the back of what had already been some tough performance. And so it was a big down, but it came after you're already on a downward trend. And that's what made it truly, of the historic magnitude that it was, and really back since the 30s the last time. Couple of things, comments on this one. The first one is, as this was all going on, I'm an avid reader, history books, investment books, et cetera, and was reading Buffett's Snowball biography, through September, October, November last year. And, reflecting on, his investment decisions and him talking about in the 70s some of the most amazing investments he made, buying Coca-Cola at 7x earnings or American Express at tangible book value. And until last year, people in my shoes or your shoes reading that would say, well, that's all well and good for Warren Buffett, but, we don't get to see things like Coca-Cola at 7x earnings or American Express at tangible book value, right? That was the 70s. The world's efficient. You've got to pay up for good assets. Well, we all got to see many of those assets at those prices, and you realize it's a lot harder to buy those things at those prices than it seems with the benefit of hindsight, right? Because at the time where you can buy leading, I mean, people thought Goldman Sachs' business model was so broken that the firm may not exist as a going entity. Right, that stock had gone from 250 to 57. I mean, Buffett had, you know, got his option to buy about 100. It went down another 40% from there. And yet sitting here today as we've come out of it all, people are like, gosh, obviously Goldman was going to survive, right? It's great people, broad business around the world. But it's harder at the peak of that pain than it sometimes sees. So it was very helpful to me. And when you realize when he did that, a lot of the stuff he's talking about was here. It never got quite as bad, but it was where things he thought were good got a lot cheaper, got to crazy levels. Now, the other thing that's important from here is when you go on a cumulative chart from a zero or a negative up, to get from cumulative negative 3 over 10 years to zero, you actually have to have an absolute move in the market of 50, 60, 70, 80%. And so one question we get from a lot of clients, potential clients today is, okay, maybe I sold some equities where I shouldn't, or I didn't buy more when I should have, but I've kind of missed the bounce, right? It's already kind of happened. Haven't we already had it? You know, isn't it done? Well, this chart updated for today sits at about negative 1.2. Okay, so while a lot of people sit here and say, we've had this big bounce, have I missed it? Had we not gone as low as we went in February and March, you know, aside from the peak in October and the peak in February and March, this still, over a very long period of time, equities are still look very attractive on this basis. Okay, and this isn't a be-all and end-all. This is a reversion. It is coming off the end of the 90s, where equity markets were a little more elevated. This wasn't right at the peak, you know, at the end of 1999 when the tech bubble was there. So there are comparisons that affect these things, but still, it just puts in perspective. We've had a bounce off the bottom, but equities and risky assets as risky asset classes still look pretty attractive to us. Okay, so now emerging markets within that context. So it was a painful time for equities. And you see there from Jan 1st, 08 to late October, which is where EMs bottomed, the developed world was down 48 and EMs were down 64. Okay, and I think these numbers are so big, people actually lose the magnitude of what that means, right? So some people say, well, so EMs did a bit worse, right? Develops down 50, they're down 60. It was a bit worse. If you started with $100 on January 1, the developed world investor had 52. The EM investor had 36. To get from 36 back to 52, you've got to go up by nearly 50%, right? So through one lens, people look at that and they say, oh, well, EM's underperformed by 10 or 15% in a down market. That's arithmetically, but on the geometric way that means for money, you know, you got 50% to gain there to get there, right? So it really was painful. And as Darren alluded to in the intro, what was so painful for us as fundamental investors, constructive on EMs, was that the source of the whole crisis didn't even reside in EMs. You know, in the 90s, the Asian crisis, it resided on issues in Asia, imbalances in those economies, imbalances in their FX reserves and issues. Tequila crisis in Latin America was issues there. Russian crisis was issues there. This was the developed financial system, consumers in the US, in the UK, in Spain, in Ireland, even in Australia, who had just gone way out on the leverage curve, given money was cheap. I mean, there was the whole system funneled it. But the lesson was, and what was so shocking to us, when people flee risky assets, you know, they shoot first and ask questions later. So on the way down, you know, there's no, well, is China better than India, better than Brazil, better than Russia? It's like EM equities are riskier than developed world equities, and they're riskier than bonds, and bonds are riskier than US treasuries. And at the peak of the pain there, you know, to buy a treasury bond, you had to pay more than $100. We got for a day or two there, we had to pay $100.10 or whatever for a $100 bond with short term basically no interest rates. Like, people so were freaked out about, is there anything where I'm not just going to lose money that, you know, I'm willing to actually pay a bit more for something if I think it could just stay there, right? So really, really amazing, and just keep that in perspective. So EMs, absolutely, we had our head handed to us. Everything went down a long, long way, and assets that you thought, you know, we had liked at 60, we liked more at 30, we thought we liked at 20, we really liked at 15, was 10, you know, do you want to buy any more? Yeah, I mean, it really was like that, right? It was very, very tough. Okay, so then, you know, people shot first, and said, I've seen this before. You know, EMs, you know, the story of EMs. What is it? They go up, they go down. They go up, they go down. And then suddenly this time at the bottom, as risk returned, as the world didn't go under, as we didn't see massive devaluations of currencies in many cases, we did in, there's been sporadic ones, but many EM currencies, while they went down a bunch, you know, they went down less than Australia, some of them, you know. And again, we've seen the Aussie dollar come back a long way there too. It's remarkable in this crisis how quickly money flowed back to risky assets, right? So from the bottom there, from October 27, 2008, 88% in emerging markets, 27% in developed world. That's in US dollar denominated, which is what I'm using as the base currency here. So really a pretty big move. And again, it needed to be a big move to recover some of that, and it did more than recover the underperformance. And for an investor from Jan 1 last year to today, you actually did do better in EMs than the developed world already, right? You have more than regained that, modestly, not by an enormous amount, but you did. But it has been a big move back. It has been kind of encouraging, you know, some modest feeling of vindication, although again, it's been a head spinner. So that's the recent past. What I think is, you know, this one surprises people more than anything we probably share in meetings. If we go back one chart here, so last year was the worst year for emerging market equities in the history of emerging markets, okay, in terms of that decline. And again, that magnitude of $100 went to 36 through there, right? It was really painful. So we had a bit of a bounce from the end of October, but I'm going to make the end point the end of last year. So we're not going to give EMs the chance to have had all that bounce, right? So even after the worst year in emerging market history, we saw the cumulative return to developed equities was negative over 10 years, right? It's about negative 5, 10% on a cumulative basis through the end of last year. What do you all think the return to emerging markets has been, given that we were just coming off the worst year in emerging market history? We just lost two-thirds of our money, Neil. Right? So developed world's negative 5, 10, cumulative 10-year return. You lost money. You know, and I won't ask you all to throw out a number. Some people say 10, some people bullish. You know, EM's probably up 20, 30%. So EM's, over the last 10 years, 112% up in an absolute return, US dollars, after having had the worst year in EM history, after losing two-thirds of that money. And again, this again benefits, like anything investing, start and end points matter a lot. And this is coming off, you know, 1998, so you were still living with some of the flu from the Asian crisis. Developed world was doing a little better, headed into the tech bubble, but still had further go. But still, it's remarkable, right? Most people can't fathom that after you lost, you know, 60% of your money in EM last year, for a 10-year investor, they're up 100 in EM and they lost money in the developed world, right? So it is volatile, and people say they go up and down, but we would argue that the ups and downs can over long periods of time still lead to more than people realise. And it's not always just what comes up, what goes down. It has paid to be there over time. Okay, so let's go deeper in emerging markets. My point early on, EMs are underappreciated their importance in the world. I'm going to start at the bottom of this one and go up. In the MSCI All Country World, which is the broadest global equity benchmark today that we get held to for all our mandates, emerging markets represent 11% of the MSCI All Country World today. It's got down to as low as 8.5%, it's 11% today. So call it 10% of the world, right? And most clients or potential clients we meet with seem to think about it in about that kind of bucket. They're thinking about it as a bit of a niche asset class, something I'm intrigued with, I probably should think about, but it's not really a huge, you know, it's there, but it's kind of a little on the side, right? So the first adjustment we make is MSCI uses free float weighted indices. So think back to Australia's history. When the government first floats a bit of Commonwealth Bank or Telstra, MSCI only counts the bit that floats when they float 10%, but then they float the next 10 and the next 10 and the next 10, and ultimately you get a bunch more in the index, even though that company was always there doing it, even though you could own it as an equity investor once there was 10 or 20 out there, but you see it. So firstly, we just adjust for the free float, and EMs are 20% of the world. Because again, not surprisingly, a lot of government enterprises that are in the process of being privatised that have some parts of them out there, but not all of them. But like Australia, probably going to be a pretty inevitable march that more of those will float and that will go up. But this is a more relevant one. If you look at global GDP today, 30% roughly of the world's GDP resides in emerging market economies. 30. Right? So this isn't a little 10% on the side asset class. This is now a quarter to a third of the world's economy is in these, you know, in these emerging markets. And yet, again, it's viewed through an investment lens very often of 10%. Now, be clear here, I'm not arguing 30% direct in EM investments, because there's a lot of developed world multinationals we invest in that also get a lot of their growth and exposure from EM, right? But it shows what a key part of the world this is, and how, and that's why I say you can't talk about these aside from the global economy, because they're such a big part of it. So that's GDP. If you adjust that, obviously prices in the EM world are cheaper on a PPP basis. It's nearly 50%. If you look at energy consumption, FX reserves, obviously population land mass, it's even bigger. But it's much more than 10% of the world, and much more than we estimate more than half the growth. We'll see that here. Okay, so now looking at our view of the world, how it's changing, how EMs fit within that as we look forward, where we've been, where we are, where we're going. And again, some of this is our guess, some of this is clearer, some of this is really unknown. I'll try and highlight that. This is the old norm, and I'm saying this was the world 2004 through 2007, late 2007. This is before all hell broke loose. This is the transition period that we're still in now. We're arguably the transition. We never knew how long the duration would be and how severe it would get. At points it seemed very severe and that it would go for a very long time. Increasingly, seems like it may be a little less severe than we all thought, and we may move out of it, but we're still unknown. We're still in this. And then this is where we think the world's going to for the next 5 years. You know, it's harder to think much more than 5 years out in many things. So global GDP, again, underappreciated, I think, by many. For those years where the world was growing at 5%, that was really unprecedented. And what it reflected was the developed world was growing. You know, consumers had too much access to finance. They were spending. And the emerging world was growing at the same time. And we'll see in some later stuff, it was that synchronized growth that was really different versus much of history, okay, and led to that elevated level. Obviously, right now in the transition, the world is not growing. The entire developed world is shrinking, with the exception of the lucky country Australia, and potentially Canada. So, and this is really pretty astounding, right? Australia may end up as the only country, developed world country, that can claim in the greatest modern crisis since the Great Depression to not even have a recession in their own economy. I mean, it's pretty crazy. I mean, yeah, we got close 0.1% or something, but that's remarkable. The whole developed world shrinking, emerging world still net-net growing, net-net nothing's happening right now, you know. And then we think going forward, the new norm, 2 to 3%, right? Let's split the difference. The developed world, we think, will remain more challenged for many years than it was. You know, finance companies, banks, the whole securitization market won't return to what it was. Parts of it will return, parts of it won't, parts of it will change. But the deleveraging process in the developed world is not a four-quarter event. You know, we don't get through to the fourth quarter and say, oh, we've lapped that, we're okay. This is a 3, 4, 5 year event. Savings rates in America, in Europe, have really spiked, but that savings rate has to be there for a long time to rebuild consumer balance sheets, right? You know, if you're $50,000 in debt and you suddenly get religion, you're like, okay, I've got to spend less than I make. I mean, it has to go for a while to pay down the debt, right? We think the emerging world's still going to grow pretty well, and we'll talk about that. But somewhere it's less than 5, it's more than 0, you know, 2 to 3. Inflation, what was, again, so amazing before, despite this unbelievable growth, it was pretty modest. And that was as the emerging world had all this excess capacity, whether it was labour, as capital was cheap, industrial capacity was cheap to bring on. And then what was so crazy in this transition is as the world fell apart, in one sense, inflation is spiking, right? So oil hits 145 as the world's in the midst of kind of falling apart. And so you had the inflation from the good years spiking just as the world was really feeling the pain. And that was, you know, what was so confusing. The biggest unknown to us at T. Rowe as we struggle, or as I struggle with my portfolio as an example, in the new norm, this whole deflation versus inflation, here and now, with 10% unemployment in the US. And it's actually even worse than that, right? I was reading an article the other day, headline unemployment of 9.6% in America. Average American's been out of work 26 weeks in that number, half a year, longest in history. So many people have given up looking for a job that if you adjust for those who've just said, you know what, I'm 57, you know, I got laid off for the second time, I've been trying for half a year, you know what, I'm going to retire early or whatever and change. If you adjust for those and then adjust for the people who are working part-time, still looking for full-time, the number's something on the order of 13 or 14%, which means one in seven Americans, you know, are either out of a job or meaningfully underemployed or given up, right? It's really staggering. When you have that much excess capacity in an economy, that much labor sitting at the side, when you have Japanese factories still very low utilizations, obviously there's very strong deflationary forces. Very hard to get inflation to come back when there's so many excess resources still to be used. So that's the deflation case. On the inflation case, there has never been in the world a time in history where all the governments of the world basically in unison just say, let's print money, you know, let's put our foot on the gas, let's lower interest rates to zero. And even countries and regions that never really were doing that before, right? China had been very diligent, worried about their economy overheating and had really clamped hard in 07. And that was part of what was confusing with China in this downturn, that it was being slowed down from stuff that was stronger, that the government had tried to be responsible, but then the world fell apart and then they had to change it. You know, the ECB, who for so long had just said, you know what, our mandate, it's nothing to do with growth, it's only inflation. And if you let that genie out of the bottle, you never get it back, and so we know the world's slow, we're not going to change. Well, they got religion too, right? And they said, you know what, this is really bad, we just, okay, rates go to zero, you know, print the money. So that's the yin and the yang. My perspective on how this plays out is that it's not a static equation, right? And this is a bit I think most people missed in some sense during the downturn, that sitting there in October as the world's falling apart and people are saying, you know, the government hasn't done enough. Well, the government did more things and they kept doing more things and more governments did more things. And I think it's been pretty clear the message that most governments are sending is the risk of deflation is just too huge and we're going to keep the foot on the gas. And if the price of that is we overheat a little coming out of it, so be it. But that's better than, you know, God forbid they ramp up rates now and we go back down and the loss in consumer confidence in the system and, you know, it's hard to recover. So my personal bias is I think we get inflation again at some level or it becomes a fear, but it's probably a 2-3 year out event because of how much excess capacity is there. So emerging world within this. So when the world was growing really fast, emerging markets were a really strong source of growth. It was about 50% of global growth. But the developed world was growing and EMs were a smaller part of the world. Right? So think about the math. The developed world was, you know, EMs were maybe 15% of the world or 20, not 30, and developed world's growing. So EMs had a big contribution, but it wasn't the majority. Today, it's more than 100% because the developed world's shrinking. Right, so it's all the growth, but we think going forward, if you run the numbers, you know, at some reasonable guesstimates, about 2/3 of GDP growth in the world over the next 5 years probably comes from emerging markets. So again, compare that number again to the 10% in the MSCI All Country World, you know, particularly for a growth investor like us. We're looking for profitable, growing, productive assets that we can co-own over periods of time, you know, and be owners of productive assets that are growing. 66% of the growth is coming from there. It's got to be something we spend a lot of time looking at. And then on valuations and risk premiums, this is also a bit interesting. You know, valuation didn't look crazy before this all crashed. And why was that? Well, it's because profit margins got so high, right? So valuation actually did look kind of expensive on price to book. It's always easy with hindsight. That's the number we should have been looking at. But on the earnings number, it didn't look that bad. On the free cash number, it looked pretty good too. Financing was cheap. Margins were high. It seemed not as expensive. Then valuation went haywire. It actually looked really cheap on some metrics, really expensive on others. Great example of that one. Japan's fiscal year ends at the end of March. And so early this year in February, if you looked in Bloomberg, what's Japanese equities trading at? I think it reached 359 times earnings for the 09 year. And what that means, be clear, is the entire Japanese corporate system was break even. It was making no money, I think you've got to put a very high multiple on no profit to get to an equity valuation, because at some time it returns. So you had the whole of the Japanese economy that had made money in the first bit of their financial year, and when those technology companies, you go from 85% utilization to 30, you're just bleeding money. And not only did you not make money, you gave up everything you'd made in the first half of the year and you got nothing. So the hard thing coming out of this is, given companies actually, if I summarize global 2Q earnings, most companies missed on their revenue line. If we thought revenues were going to be down 15 for an average company, they were down 17. But if we thought profits were going to be down 27, they're only down 25. They've actually done a remarkable job cutting costs. And that is the unemployment. That's the travel budgets. That's the fact I hear the conference attendance here is up. Many things we go to are down. You know, less people are allowed to fly the back of the bus, buy the advance ticket, you know, no taxis, rent-a-car, whatever it is. I mean, companies cut back really hard. And surprisingly, you know, that really was good for earnings in the here and now. But what makes it really tough is you can't run a business like that forever. And so as we come out of this, how quickly do the companies rehire? How quickly do they let you fly on an unrestricted ticket or front of the bus? Or, you know, how much does that change? And that's the hard thing to know from here. Profits here and now were better than we thought at the bottom, but the leverage coming off this is the thing we're trying to work out. And then finally, on risk premiums, they were extremely low. Again, people had forgotten there was a price to risk, that things can go wrong. They got unbelievably high. In many asset classes, higher than they've ever been. And they've actually come down quicker than most people would have thought, but we're still probably modestly above an average level for risk premiums in many asset classes, you know. Snapshot of the world economy. Again, how much time have we got here? A little bit. This again, 11% of the world, 30% of GDP, two-thirds of GDP growth. They are growing this year, although, again, make no mistake, this whole coupling debate, and we talked a bit about this last year, it's not black or white, right? These things were never decoupled. They were never fully coupled, right? We think it is different than it used to be, but it's not so different that they're not affected. And so their growth is 1.6%, right? This is meant to be the fast-growing part of the world, and there are bits of it that are going backwards. Russia is going backwards at 5, 6, 7% this year. You know, China's still growing. They stepped on the gas. But the developed world's all shrinking. But here, they get back pretty quickly to 4% growth, which, again, for 30% of the world's economy, growing at 4%, that's pretty meaningful and pretty bullish to us for equity opportunities. How are they doing this? They're investing. So 30% of GDP continuing to be invested in productive assets. And what is different now versus 15 years ago is that they're largely self-funding that. The savings rate, they're not dependent on Western capital nearly as much. They're investing a lot, but there's a lot of savings. There's a lot of FX reserves. They can actually control their own destiny much better than they could. And that's where some is the same, but some is different. And that's when you've seen EM equities bounce 100%. People have realized, you know what, they're not as dependent on all this as we thought. There are linkages. China is impacted. Here's one more of that. Again, we get the question from people, same old, same old. They go up, they go down, they've always grown faster. Is it really any different? Yes, it is. So from 80 to 2000, this surprises most people enormously. The blue is EM, the orange is developed, the green is the middle. Emerging markets for that 20 years actually didn't really outgrow as an overall area the developed world. And why was that, right? Sure, India was growing fast, China was growing fast. Well, the thing was, they weren't growing again in synchronization. So, you know, maybe India was having a good patch and, you know, Latin America was struggling through its tequila crisis. Maybe Asia was improving again, but Russia was having a problem. They weren't all going together. And so EMs were a fertile field, but not in unison. And the developed world, by the way, was going through a 20-year period where access, cost of capital went way down, financing went up, and so that was fueling growth. At the start of 2000, it did really change. So EMs diverged. Okay, so this last decade was different. It wasn't just the same, because they all started growing in unison at the same time as all that financing wave, although it still continued, the incremental part of that was less. And so while we were not decoupled, while emerging markets did go down when the developed world went down, that gap is still as big as it has been, right? And so that's where, to us, It's not decoupled, it's not coupled, it is somewhere in between, and it is different to 20 years ago, you know. You know, this is a more fertile area. One more, just briefly touch on it. We can do some of this in questions too, if people want some more thoughts. Now that emerging markets are 30% of the world economy, GDP roughly, it probably makes sense, right, to think about it more than just one group. You know, Japan is 8-10% of the world, and it gets considered itself. You know, the UK gets considered itself a little bit. This is 30%, and it's just one big bucket, right? So the point here is these markets are tremendously diverse, tremendously different, face very, very different investment challenges for us as investors trying to access them and what the different parts are. So you get something like China, far and away the biggest, 3x times any one of those other ones, a ton of growing very fast, partly because from a political point of view, you know, to stay in power, they got to keep helping this rural migration and they need to create jobs. Unbelievable firepower with $2 trillion of reserves and unbelievable surplus, which in one sense is good, but it's part of the imbalance of that economy with the exports. An average GDP, about what I think most people sitting in this room probably think an emerging market is. It's not $500 or $1,000, they're on the way up, but it's not $10,000, right? And so China, in one sense, looks beautiful. And this was the first market everyone ran back to, right? China and Brazil were the first two that really ran. The problem in China is the government, again, trying to manage that social harmony. They change the rules whenever they want, you know. Last year, China Mobile was the world's biggest wireless telecom company. It still is. 500 million plus SIM cards, China Mobile SIM cards out there. Right, half a billion. It's really, really astounding. So the government, though, is sitting there saying, you know what, we've got one company, and they don't have a lot of wire line in China, right? They didn't put a lot of wires to homes except in Beijing and Shanghai. And so they want to make sure that companies still invest and someone doesn't get too dominant. And so they just change the rules overnight. They announce, you know what, we're reorganizing Chinese telecom. China Mobile, you've lost the right. You are not allowed to use the 3G technology that the rest of the Western world is using. We're giving that right to China Unicom, who is the weakest telecom player. So we'll shake it up, right? We're going to give them the benefit of the whole world's R&D in 3G. We're going to take that off you. We're going to make you reinvest in some stuff, right? And that may be a very good social decision for China. You know, China Mobile, shaken up a little, has to reinvest. Unicom gets an advantage. But if you're an investor in China Mobile, sitting in our shoes, that can be really tough. I mean, thankfully, we weren't. But that's the kind of issue that even in a good economy, if the government can just change the rules like that, that's what we have to watch. The other thing in China we struggle with is management. A lot of Chinese companies were state-owned, so they weren't started by an entrepreneur. They weren't set up to be a business per se, and there's not a leader who built his team, her team, you know, had a vision. It's often a bureaucrat put in place for a couple of years on the way to a next assignment. Right, and so you don't know what their interests are. Some of them are put in place and told you got to get some profit out of this. Some of them, it's social responsibility. Some of them, and so trying to, it's not like investing in companies in many other places. Okay, so a quick snapshot of China. Just contrast that with India. You know, India a lot earlier in the development. Again, 1,000 GDP per capita versus 3 or versus 10,000. These very different infrastructure. If any of you have been to India, again, it's night and day versus China. Right. And so in one sense, through one lens, people sit there and say, India's more magical. It's got a lot more juice, right? We're earlier on, going to make more money out of that. The problem in India's case is the economy, they have a lot less reserves and the state of the country's finances is a lot worse. So they don't have the firepower to just do what China's been doing. They're much more beholden to balancing trade-offs because they don't have it all. They're also more energy dependent relative to the size of their economy than China. And so interestingly, India was one of the countries when oil went from 50 to 140, they were in real trouble. When oil went from 140 to 50, you know, and Brazil and Russia were like, oh my God, you know, the whole economy just changed. That was a good thing for India, right? And so India has been moving in a different way because there's different things there. Now, India, in contrast to China, great management teams, you know, Western educated, get more Oxford, Cambridge, Harvard people there than in many other parts of the world. Very, very thoughtful business people, often family dynasties, run their businesses, own 30, 40% of them, wish they owned 50, hadn't sold 10. So interests very aligned, very entrepreneurial, very savvy, but you got the issue of the country dynamics are a little more uncertain, and the political situation was frankly a roadblock that's been clearing up recently, and that was part of the catalyst there. And then lastly, you got something like Russia, that again, energy and materials, 76% of traded cap in Russia. Right, so if oil's going from 140 to 50, nothing else can, you're going to feel that pain. Now, if you believe energy's, oil's going back to 100, Russia, given the people have fled it, is probably going to be an interesting place. So again, we can take more questions later, but it is a really diverse landscape there now, and it is something, we feel at T Row where it makes sense to have in-region resources in each of these, because it is very different. It fundamental analysis does really help, and there is a lot of dispersion, and so it does lead itself, to my mind, to active management a little more than some other areas. That was just a snapshot of since the start of last year. So you see the first two people did come back to China and Brazil. Easier stories in some sense in their own way. Net EM still did developed, even though you had that mass, as I've said, where you had to gain a lot to catch up, but you did. Russia's still massively lagged. We've had a lot of these. We still do have some, but we're still adding in Russia. India looks bad there. Part of that was the Indian market actually was still going up at the end of 07 and 08 when China had already gone down. So it's a little bit comparison there. So I'm not going to pause there. Last one that's relevant, though, obviously, EMs as an asset class is, are they crazy expensive? Tech might have been the best story in the world in 2000, but if it's at 45 times earnings, even a good thing at a price isn't good. So this one, emerging market multiples over time, developed world, EMs have traditionally been at a discount, although not always. Back in the mid-90s, you had a period there, briefly there, they kind of closed. Asian crisis, massive dispersion. We'd got to the point before the sell-off where we were roughly in line. And again, so you had more growth in EM, arguably more risk, and it was kind of there. Again, when people sold off, they said, oh, I've seen what happens here, right? This goes out. Well, it kind of spread out briefly, but, it's caught up. So they're at a modest discount today. You're getting more growth. You're paying a little less for it, but you do have more risks. The other thing that those numbers you've got to be very careful of, the mix of the economies is very different, right? So the U.S. Or Europe, you've got healthcare stocks, you've got IT stocks, you've got things that arguably the businesses are a little more predictable. You get a lot of metals mining, lower multiples. So some would argue EM valuations, some of them are actually at premiums, but we're probably about fair. So it doesn't look crazy, but it's not as cheap as it was, but it still seems like for someone constructive on that growth like us, it's there. So just some closing comments. 08 was tough, and it was nowhere more tough than EM from the equity point. Despite the fact that we think the world does grow slower going forward, we think that relative outgrowth of EM holds, probably more true than just about ever, as the whole financial delevering of the developed world is clearer than ever now, which leads to that advantage. We think you will continue to get dispersion of returns, not just developed emerging, but even within emerging. It's really important to think about, given how big a part of that world is now, some of that dispersion and long term. And then the final one Darren alluded to, be very clear. We're not saying, it's all about just a big allocation to EM direct. We are overweight emerging markets in terms of direct exposure, but you can get a lot of great companies domiciled in the developed world with great emerging market exposure, right? So part of the reason I own Procter & Gamble today, they got great brands with 30% exposure in the emerging world, and as you get that development there, people do want branded stuff. In fact, some of the most brand-conscious consumers are in the emerging world. Even though they have less, that bias to want to step up and show they've moved up a rung is even more than in the developed world at times. So you've got to think about direct versus indirect. You've got to be very careful about the index again. Beware of what that weight is. Is it free float? Is it full? Is it the economy? What the sectors are. So you've got to be careful with that math stuff there. We think the bigger the opportunity set you go after, makes sense to us, the more likely you are to hit some, find some good investments. And the fundamental analysis helps. There's dispersion out there, and knowing what you invest in is a good thing always, never more so than now. So pause and questions.
Well, can we thank Scott? I think it's fantastic to have you back. fantastic to have you back a year later. I sat through the same presentation last year. It's fantastic to get that perspective.
So was it different than what you said? Did you think I'd be more defensive, more aggressive?
I've got one or two questions that hopefully I get to ask. But before I do, Caden, would you like to do a quick sum up?
Well, thanks, Scott. I mean, I think you can see from the slide there's a lot of meat in that presentation. I think you really look forward to reading the research paper when it's posted a bit later. So my three key takeouts, I guess, from that was the first one, that slide about the long-term average returns, where we are today and where we should be compared to historic. There's still good value out there in equities, so I think that's an important point to take away from today. Where do we find that? Obviously here, a big thematic still is emerging markets potentially as a way. Many ways to access that. You can go directly to emerging markets, but be aware that there are global companies who are also operating there that can access this. And I think finally, I guess, there was this point really throughout this about emerging markets, that crash didn't really appear to be based so much on fundamentals, at least in their balance sheets of the governments in those nations, except for their savings rate. The fact that they are now investing a lot of money into productive assets, unlike a lot of other developed economies, etc. And therefore, it sort of reminded us about this balance between markets can be very sentimental-driven, but we need to often focus on fundamentals. And I guess that's what I wanted Scott to sort of address to us, because it seems that, you know, when we've had this really steep rally in, say, cyclicals or in emerging markets, we still appear to be, like, sentiment-driven or macro-driven. Are markets now, you know, prepared to focus on fundamentals?
Yeah, I think it's actually where markets have gone back to now. It is much more about fundamentals again, right? So at the bottom, a lot of it was more that adage of when there's kind of, you know, fear and blood in the streets, you know, you just got to step up and buy something, right? You got to have that conviction, whether or not it's always that clear. Now that that is past, I think people are being a lot more nuanced about taking. You have some time to analyze, right? For a while there, people's heads are just spinning. Just don't know what to do. You thought you bought it cheaper. It's a lot cheaper. Now, I really do think valuations per this one back here, again, they don't look absurdly cheap. They don't look absurdly expensive. This is both developed and emerging world. Many companies, again, we have these charts that look like they were once up here, they're down here, they're somewhere in here, but it's a big range in the middle, right? So trying to work out where we go forth from here, is what it's all about. And so I really sit here today. I own 110 stocks in the portfolio I run today, which may sound like a lot, but part of that is because I see a ton of, I mean, there's a lot of things I still feel very good I'm going to make 40 or 50% over 2 years. Now, there's less things I think I'm going to make 100% over a year or 2 years, you know, and maybe get lucky to do that. So you've had some of that. But there's still a lot of things out there. I think the hardest thing on that fundamental side, as I alluded to earlier, is just predicting leverage in business models as revenues return. It's a really hard thing when companies cut costs so brutally to work out how much of that sticks and how much of that doesn't. You know, if you fired 1,000 people, do you rehire 200, 500, 800, or 1,000, and over what period? And that really impacts where those earnings go. You know, if you cut your travel budget by 50%, we see some companies who tell us, you know what, we cancelled our sales meeting last year, and we had them all do it on basically like an advanced Skype. Everyone's sitting doing webcams and doing this, right? And actually, it went pretty well. Frankly, we had one company say to us, you know what, at conferences, we fly all these people in from around the world, and they haven't seen their mates for a long time, and so they don't actually even show up to a bunch of the sessions. They're off having coffee or whatever. On the webcam, we can tell, are they there? They got to log in, you know, there's no whatever. And so there are some companies saying, you know, some of the things we were forced to do were actually, you know, we'd always been wary, oh, you have to get together and meet people. And now they said, you know what, maybe we don't. And so that's the bit that's really hard and uncertain and not always knowable. But at least now, as it's more normal in there, I feel like there is a lot to analyze. It's not, you know, not impossible at this point. So I'm still bullish. The further out you go, the more I think equities are higher. I will be really surprised if in 12 or 18 months equities aren't meaningfully higher from here. It would not shock me in 1 or 2 months if we give back a bunch, if we gain. No one ever knows in the short term, right? You just never know. But again, my portfolio, I feel full of good stuff.
Scott, good question. When are we going to lose this emerging market tag? We had Andrew here a bit earlier saying that Samsung is a Korean company which was an emerging market. Very soon it's going to be a developed market,
yeah.
But the company actually hasn't changed at all.
Yeah.
So when are we going to start seeing some blurring here?
Well, no, I mean, I think the thing is, from investors' point of view, and that's something we always highlight to people, that same point, I mean, looking at things from a regional basis is really fraught with danger. My primary way I analyse stuff in the portfolio is starting sector by sector. Right, so I take each sector globally, say, okay, consumer discretionary. Now let's look across the globe within consumer discretionary. What are the most fertile subparts of the consumer discretionary world? You know, subtypes of businesses, you know, is it leisure stuff, hotel stuff, is it discretionary spending, is it US, Europe, Japan, emerging markets, and find that there. Because that's a pretty true opportunity set. The problem in the regions is it does all move around. And the one I often give people, if I own Hyundai, it shows up today as an EM holding. If I own Toyota, it shows up as a Japanese holding. If I own Ford, that's a US holding. And frankly, they're all global auto companies that, from your point of view, my risk profile in all of them isn't really that de minimisly different, right? But it looks so different. So I think it is that the people who are thoughtful recognise it's blurred and are wary of placing too much emphasis on that analysis. But there's no easy way, so I say it's blurry, there is no easy way to clean it up. At one point we tried to look at our portfolio and say, let's look at the profit exposure of every company by region and work out what it really is. And it's hard, you don't get that level of detail from most companies to be able to do it for everything. So, great question.
Yeah, a couple of questions, yeah. Sorry, yeah, go on.
The China story, I was just wondering if you could provide some comments on China's one-child policy and how that phenomenon might impact on the sustainability of the China story and the impacts on China.
Yeah, I mean, and again, I'm not going to profess to be an expert on this. You know, China is very interesting in that sense, right? Because demographically, China is facing an aging... So people look at Japan, right? And you've probably heard people say, oh, Japan is a really tough place to invest. Demographics are horrible. It is shrinking population, shrinking workforce, people spending less. Stay out of Japan. Well, actually, China has an aging issue very similar to Japan because of that, in some ways exacerbated, which isn't what you normally think of as an emerging market, right? India is what you think of there with a whole bunch of young people coming through into the workforce, right? So China has a different dynamic. But you've still got all this enormous labor sitting in rural areas, you know, to come in, which is the offset. So the one-child policy has impacted that demographic stuff. I mean, also, you know, you kind of see it a bit there too when all the resources of an entire family are focused on one person. It also leads to some other social issues, if you like. You know, you don't learn to share real well, you know, if everything's about you. And, you know, does that have issues down the road? You know, there too, I don't know. But it's, I guess I don't want to overstep the bounds of where I have anything meaningful to say. So, you know, demographically, it has been a big part of that issue. That is something that we watch there. There's other open questions, but it doesn't tangibly, in terms of day-to-day, what I invest in, frankly, you know, cause me huge things.
Yesterday, we ran a global emerging market class, and we had the Chinese ambassador here, and he was asked exactly that question, and he had a long answer, but he said, he basically said, we've got a lot of problems in China.
We don't know.
That's not the one we worry about the most. Next question.
Yeah.
Enjoy the presentation. Thank you.
Cheers. Thank you.
Just in regard to investing, emerging markets are always seen as high risk. But in regard to the companies that you actually invest in,
yeah,
on behalf of your organisation, are you actually investing in developed companies that are actually in emerging markets? Is that really what you're doing? Because I'm just trying to get a picture.
You're talking about the maturity of the business model and the company itself and the size and the whatever?
Yeah. Because that changes the risk profile quite dramatically.
Yeah, no, it does. Great question. And the answer is it's very across the spectrum, right? But the reason the risk comment overlay really stems most from a corporate governance point of view. Okay, in most of these countries, the government rules still change or have the potential to change more severely with less notice than in many developed world things. Now, again, developed world rules change too. We've seen all that with this crisis, right? I mean, I see yesterday the ASX is getting stripped of this thing, going to someone else, you know. I mean, stuff does change, but historically it's changed more frequently there and it continues to. So even if, great example is this one, Petrobras. So we think Brazil is one of the more developed emerging markets in many senses. It doesn't have nearly the risk profile of Russia or some of the other things, right? So relatively lower on that risk profile. And Petrobras is a really high-quality global company. You know, global oil company, best production growth of all the big ones, a lot of good things about it. But you still run into the issue, or the thing I worry about on Petrobras, and I own it, it's a meaningful position, is in an economy like that where there's still a real disparity of rich and poor, and this is a really valuable asset for the government, and they've had these great finds in the Tupi field, basically the biggest modern oil finds in modern history are there in Brazil for them. The government is toying with the notion of, well, is Petrobras kind of getting too much out of this? You know, they've won these initial ones. We've got some more things there. Should we either take more of the company? Should we have somehow put that in a separate company and make Petrobras buy more of it? Or could we do that? And it's just a little more. So even when it's one of the more friendly countries, in a sense, one of the more developed companies, some of those decisions are different than you just wouldn't have quite the same extent of that debate in the US. I mean, we're still debating energy taxes and changing tax regimes, you get some of it. But that's the struggle when I say higher risk. And again, it's not higher risk for that economy, but for you as an equity holder of Petrobras, you know, that could really hurt you. But it's a great company, developed company. And then on the flip side, when I say it's nuanced, you go down the road, I mean, you go down the risk curve to some of the risky ones, and you really don't know. You know, I mean, you get stuff in Russia and in Africa where even when you think you're in a well-run company there and you see someone own a bunch of the stock, you know, they're co-owners, they own 30%. Well, you know what? Their 30% of the shares is a different share class than your shares. And, you know, when it really matters, you know, suddenly their interests aren't as aligned and they're doing a deal and they get a special thing. And so you still have, you know, that really there, which is very hard. But you can't just not invest in that. You just got to try and, you know, risk-reward.
I'm sure we could listen to Scott all day. I mean, there's so much we can learn from you. But we're out of time, so I think for now, Darren Hall might want to say something.
Yeah, I might just close quickly. I know everyone's probably a little bit hungry, but I'll just touch on how you actually get access to some of those themes with the T. Rowe Price Global Equity Fund. And if Scott wants to chip in, feel free. But at T. Rowe Price, we do actually run a high conviction global equity portfolio. It's 60 to 100 stocks. As you probably gathered, we do provide a very broad opportunity set in where we invest, which includes developed, emerging and frontier markets. The Global Equity Fund at the moment can go plus or minus 15% to the MSCI All Country World Index into emerging markets. So as Scott highlighted, that directly. So indirectly, obviously, yeah, you can buy your developed market stocks, which are leveraged into those regions as well. And at T. Rowe Price, we're a fundamental bottom-up house, so we have our own proprietary research, which is quite important and quite critical when you are looking at emerging markets where there are perhaps a lot of mispricing opportunities and information is perhaps less well covered by analysts. And our global equity strategies at T. Rowe, we run with a single decision maker, ultimately accountable for portfolio construction, and with the global equity fund that's currently available in Australia, the person responsible for constructing that portfolio is Rob Gensler on the left of screen here. As I said from the outset, Scott is the portfolio manager for our global equity large cap strategies, very valuable input into our global equity portfolio management team. There is a whole heap of people underneath Scott and Rob that are very senior investors both across sectors and regions. That are providing input into how we go about our process. It's not simply one person trying to cover a universe of 3,000 stocks and go, guess what, I really like Petrobras, that's going in at gangbusters. There is a whole team of people, there's a whole team of analysts that are providing input along the way that we can leverage from. And one that we do highlight as an area that does require a great deal of knowledge and skill is health sciences. And if you look at the gentleman here that covers health sciences at a portfolio manager level, it's Chris Jenner, and he's a qualified medical doctor. He's got four medical doctors in his team. One of them's an ex-liver transplant surgeon at John Hopkins Memorial. So covering biotech is obviously an area as a global diversified manager is quite difficult to get your head around in terms of getting down to the nuts and bolts. So we're leveraging off the global team at T. Rowe.
I just want to go back to that. When you see on the regional side, three of our six key advisors are emerging market focused folks, because that is a big part of the world, and so we particularly do that.
All right, and David's winding me up. So if you would like to know more about how we go about our process or more about our firm, please come down and see us in the exhibition area. We have a stand. Scott will be there through lunch, and hopefully be returning, depending on your votes, in the best of due diligence session. So I'll hand it over to David.
Yeah, and with that in mind, just before you go, please take the card out of your lanyard. I just to say, I've had a 100% track record in this room of getting our speakers back. Scott was got a very popular vote last time. So please vote before you go, and hand it to Adriana as you walk out of the room. Thanks. Mm-hmm.